Sophie.
Can you say something for the start of the podcast? Like, what do you think of Writer and the Critic, the podcast?
Dead?
No, come on, say something. Give us some words.
I think that's a no comment.
Dying.
Great.
Dying. I am going to use that. That's awesome. Dying. What do you think of Writer the Critic? Dying. It's like, oh, harsh. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott. With me on Zoom this month is your co-host, Ian Mond. Hi, Ian.
Hello.
We'll see if Zoom behaves itself a little bit better than Skype, which is just being a bit echoey and I'm not liking it.
I'm trying for a lower voice I can't stand my whiny voice. So
you sound like you have COVID. I would suggest you get a test. You sound like you have a sore throat and laryngitis, so maybe go get that Q-tip shoved up your nose.
It's my telephone voice.
Jesus.
No, it doesn't work. No, okay. It's just I can't modulate properly, okay? I really am jealous of the podcasters who are just able to keep a reasonably good modulation in their tone. I just go everywhere.
Yeah, you do, I know. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. All right, so this month, since we're getting straight to the point of things now, we're talking about two books, neither of which I had read, one of which Ian had read, Mexican Gothic by Silvia Moreno Garcia and The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones. Spoilers, I liked one. I did not like the other so much.
I know which one you like.
So we thought we'd start with Mexican Gothic. I thought we'd start with Mexican Gothic because I make the running sheet, so I get to unilaterally make the decisions, which I like.
Can I take a guess which one you didn't like?
Sure.
Stephen Graham Jones.
No. There you go. You're wrong.
Ah, wow. Okay.
So, Ian, do you want to, as has become now tradition on the podcast of all, four episodes so far, read the blurb for Mexican Gothic. Okay. And again, these are both very new releases. I think both July releases, and maybe even the Only Good Indians, I think, only came out, got dropped onto my Kindle first week of August, I think, actually. Anyway, so Mexican Gothic.
Okay. So it's a long blurb. I'm just saying that here.
Summarize.
I'll read it all. This is what I do for you. An isolated mansion, a chillingly charismatic aristocrat, and a brave socialite drawn to expose their treacherous secrets. From the author of Gods of Jade and Shadow comes a novel set in glamorous 1950s Mexico. After receiving a frantic letter from her newlywed cousin begging for someone to save her from a mysterious doom, Noemi Taboada heads to a high place, a distant house in the Mexican countryside. She's not sure what she will find. Her cousin's husband, a handsome Englishman, is a stranger, and Noemi knows little about the region. Noemi is also an unlikely rescuer. She's a glamorous debutante, and her chic gowns and perfect red lipstick are more suited for cocktail parties than amateur sleuthing. But she's also tough and smart with an indomitable will, and she's not afraid, not of her cousin's new husband, who is both menacing and alluring, not of his father, the ancient patriarch, who seems to be fascinated by Noemi, and not even of the house itself, which begins to invade Noemi's dreams with vision of blood and doom. Her only ally in this inhospitable abode is the family's younger son. Shy and gentle, he seems to want to help Noemi, but might also be hiding dark knowledge of his family's past, for there are many secrets behind the walls of High Place. The family's once colossal wealth and faded mining empire kept them from prying eyes, but as Noemi digs deeper, she unearths stories of violence and madness. And Noemi, mesmerized by the terrifying yet seductive world of High Place, may soon find it impossible to ever leave this enigmatic house behind. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty
That's a pretty good blurb. Right, it's pretty good. It tells you what the book's about.
I mean, look, like all blurbs today say too much, and that one is no different. But it's very accurate.
Yeah.
and that's my thoughts on the blurb.
That's your thoughts on the blurb.
I apologize for mispronouncing the protagonist's name. So how would you pronounce it?
Well, I Googled it. It's Noemi.
Noemi.
Not all one, like separate syllables. Noami.
Noami. Okay. Yep. Yep.
At least that's the pronunciation that I was told. So hopefully that is correct.
Okay, so you didn't like it. Well, that's great. I loved it though. So this will make for an interesting conversation. So you've probably read my review.
I did. I looked that up last night.
Would you like to pick apart my review?
No, because I have absolutely no problem with the review or people who liked it. Like it's a Kirsten. I didn't hate it. I never connected with the book. It kind of bounced off me, and I think there's a few reasons for that.
Is this a COVID bounce, or is this a normal?
It's the book bounce off. And there were things I really liked about it, but I kind of never got connected, and I think a big part of that was what felt to me was a strange choice of narrational voice, I didn't really connect from it from the beginning, and then I kind of never did, so that's a shame.
Okay, you're going to have to articulate that because to me the voice is actually the strength of the novel. So
yeah.
Because for me she starts off as – and I'll let you speak,
of course.
I do this in actual team meetings.
I'll get you to expand on that, Kirsten, but first let me tell you all my thoughts.
But first let me explain my position. No, go ahead.
So it's this quasi-omniscient narrational voice. I still do think it's a very odd choice to have begun this book in from the point of view of this walk-on, walk-off, you know, love interest of Naomi's. And I'm not sure why the author chose to start with that, chose to give us this, because for most of the book, it's almost exclusively, in fact, probably exclusively in Naomi's point of view. We don't get the point of view of other characters, but it begins with the still this omniscient narrator type voice, but it begins with that sort of grounded in the point of view of, I kind of remember his name, but the young man that she's gone to that ball with. And it just felt like a really weird position to begin the book with, and I guess it invites the reader to consider Naomi from, like, to consider her externally, and that's with some of the, I guess, the language choices as well. And I guess having had that invite to consider her externally from the point of a quasi-omniscient narrator, I never really left that standpoint. So I never felt that connected with Naomi. I always felt in the position of being quite outside her and being invited for a lot of the novel to sort of judge her actions and so on, rather than being right beside her in the thick of it. And I think part of that really does come from that the decision from Moreno Garcia to begin it with this, to me, a very odd choice of point of view. And I still don't know exactly why that was done. I can't see a reason for it in the book, but it was. And that's, I think, the starting point of why it, I didn't feel invited to sit beside Naomi, but to sort of watch her from the outside. And it's really interesting. But there's a lot I liked, but I never really connected, I guess, with the book itself that much. I loved some of the sort of hallucinatory aspects of it and her dreams and you know, Moreno Garcia does these amazing cliffhangers at the end of chapters, which are fantastic. But she doesn't overdo them. It's not like every chapter ends in a cliffhanger, but when she does them, they're excellent. The mushrooms are very cool.
Straight to the mushrooms.
The mushrooms are very cool. Look, I liked. There's nothing I didn't like about the sort of, you know, the overall premise of it, or, you know, the plot and all of that. It's almost like it's partially a mystery as to why I didn't connect with this book more, because a lot of it should be totally my jam, and I think maybe weirdly that is actually part of it, because as you would know, Ian, I'm a deeply contrary person.
Yes, I do know that.
It's almost like,
and also point of view. But if you have one bugbear that I've learned over the last many years since we've known each other, point of view is it.
So, and when there's an omniscient point of view, it really has to work. They're ones I find, I guess they have to work the hardest. to draw me in, and this one.
See, she does the same thing in Gods of Jade and Shadow, not for as lengthy, but in as much as that it starts slightly outside the character and then draws in.
See, we'll talk about Stephen Graham Jones's book later, but he was also using an omniscient point of view, and I fell into that book so easily, and I adored that book, but we'll get to that. I know for me personally, the omniscient and definitely the quasi-omniscient points of view I don't connect with as quickly, and I think part of that is that I guess I don't like being, as a reader, invited into the position where I am too observational and too external to what is being experienced by the characters, and that's what an omniscient narrator invites you to do. And with this one, I don't know, the prose was very I'm actually kind of surprised that you really liked it so much in terms of the prose, because it's very florid and very I know, but it's not the kind of minimalist prose that you've talked about liking recently and being sort of a bit impatient with prose. It's a bit more poetic or a bit more flowery. She has some like amazing turns of phrase. I've got a lot of good things to say about this book. I just didn't connect with it. I didn't love it.
So I do like the prose because I mean it's called Mexican Gothic. It is. So I knew what I was getting
and
into.
And it is true to label, like, folks. I mean, that's what you're getting.
Yeah. Yes. And what I enjoyed, and again, I'm going to mispronounce the main character's name a couple of times, so I apologize in advance. So Naomi's I like how Mariana Garcia has this character who is potentially quite shallow but extremely smart, but very much focused on her class and her privilege, but is also willing to, you know, get her hands dirty.
Yeah.
And it's those different tensions and conflicts that run throughout the whole novel that I really, really enjoyed. And so my issues around point of view is not the same as yours. So yeah. I don't have a particular issue with a book that starts somewhere else and then shifts very quickly. I have other bugbears, and this book then, which one of which you write is florid prose and flowery prose. But this didn't bug me either, because when it needs to, it doesn't beat around the bush as a book, especially the last 30, 40 pages.
Mm.
When it needs to punch you in the gut, it punches you in the gut. And then also behind all that, there's the historical elements to it as well, because she's set it in the 1950s at a point where Mexico itself, and I did some research around this because I knew nothing, because, hello, I'm Australian Jew living in Australia. And so I did some research, and yeah, Mexico was having a major economic boom at the time. And there was that nouveau riche within Mexico, Mexican industrialists, et cetera, which her father, Noemi's father, is. And it's that interesting sort of fight between the nouveau riche of Mexico, and I don't think they would call that, but I'm using that term, of Mexico versus this colonial British old money family who are rotting literally on the inside. And that fight, to me, that just made this different to most things that I've read, and that's why I loved it, frankly. That was it. That was – there's something – with me, it's always that one thing that's different or new. Is something I've not seen before or is unexpected. Yeah. And that was it. It's that clash between old money and new money, but particularly from a colonial perspective. So, I mean, the old money, new money thing is not new as a concept, but it's that colonial thing. And then when you hear the stories about – how they abused the miners and the silver mining and all that. I found it resonated. It hit hard.
And I really loved the use of the Gothic as a genre, and I guess the tropes of the Gothic to overlay that theme of colonialism and post-colonialism. And I thought that was really, really smart and quite a clever take on what the Gothic can do, because, you know, the Gothic as a genre is one of its primary concerns is that the past is never buried, it's never left behind, it always pushes through into the present, and the ramifications that of things that happened generations and generations and generations ago are never truly left behind, and the slate is never truly wiped clean. And obviously that is an excellent metaphor for how colonialism works and the scars that it leaves behind, and not even the scars, the open seeping wounds that it continues to foster, even when, you know, most of the active, I guess, mechanisms of colonialism are no longer in force at the moment. But obviously, its legacy and its continued sort of, I guess, more subcutaneous mechanisms are still very much active and in play. So I thought that was excellent.
And it still has the conventional trappings of the Gothic. There's a lot of gaslighting going on. She's gaslit across the whole novel. None of this is true, Noemi. It's all in your head. That's constantly done. It's got the sleaze and the eroticism.
And it's got your mustache twirling villain, and it's got your it's got, you know, what's her name? Florence, the mother. Yes. You know,
she's rule obsessed, as I said,
this you know, she's the sort of the Mrs. Danvers character. I mean, she touches all of the bases of the Gothic, and she does a really good job. And
She gives us a version of the Gothic male hero, but he's so anodyne and bland. That's what I actually find him distinctly, and I don't know if it's deliberate, but he's just the least memorable character in the whole book. Florence's son Francis.
And that's another thing, actually, because at the end of it, where Naomi is, the intimation is that she is or may be willing to fall in love with Francis, and it's like, really though, like I don't know. That felt a bit forced. It felt like the conventions closing in and saying, well, hey, now we've left with the heroine and potentially the hero stand-in. So, of course, they must get together or the book must intimate that they might get together. And I just thought that was an off note for me, just because of the way I get that Naomi, you know, liked Francis and, you know, cared about him as a person. It felt a bit forced at the very end where he's on his sick bed and she's going, you know what, I could really – I might actually be falling in love with this guy. It's like, are you though?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. As a character, he can't compete with anyone else in the novel.
Mm.
And although there is a hint as well that she's got a thing for the doctor,
who kind of where that might have been going. I'm glad there was no, like, sort of romance subplot that went through here. And maybe that's why the ending with Francis felt a little bit forced and a little bit of a box tick, because there wasn't really that – if there was anything, there was that horrible toxic sort of attraction repulsion with Virgil, part of which is explained by the properties of the fungus and what it does. I don't know. That the ending just like, really – like I'm glad they burnt down the house. I think that was a magnificent use of the Gothic trope. <It's> fantastic. This conflagration back in the – I do wonder about spores travelling on the – anyway. but yeah.
You're always worried about spores.
I'm always worried about spores. As I said, there's a lot I did like about this book. It wasn't that I didn't like it. It's just I just really didn't connect with it, so I didn't get that – sort of immersive experience, and I read it a lot of it I appreciated quite intellectually, and I appreciated a lot of what she was doing with the Gothic. As I said, I thought it was an excellent use of the Gothic to talk about post-colonialism and what colonialism does and how its effects reverberate through post-colonial structures, and that was really great, like really smart. And but yeah, I don't know, the florid prose did perhaps get to me a little bit. I think she has a magnificent turn of phrase, and sometimes that is lost in the baroqueness of the language. But again, baroque language is part of this genre to some extent. It's a part of.
Do you have examples
of the really good prose? Yeah. just generally, the language is, as we said, is quite heightened, it's quite baroque, and that is part of this particular subgenre of this type of writing, and that's fine. It's just not I don't find it incredibly appealing, and I did find that some of the
because I loved how Howard Doyle is first described, you know, his ancient pale features, the color of a slug, you know, gouged with wrinkles. It's
yeah.
Look, you've got a clear image of Howard Doyle.
Yeah, and look, she has really good turns of phrase, and I did highlight a few. One of them, for example, she's talking about Florence and well, she's not. The narrator's talking about Florence. And the words did not seem outright hostile, but Florence's disapproval was thick as treacle, coating each and every syllable. Like, it's just, there's some very novel and striking turns of phrase. As I said, the dream sequences and things are really weird and strange. And, like, she does a really good line in keeping the reader off kilter, because there were, like, more than once I would be reading a section and going, oh, no, this has to be a dream. And it turns out not to be a dream, and vice versa. So she does a good line in, I guess, the weird and the grotesque, and you're not certain a lot of the time whether Naomi is having one of her dreams/hallucinations/sleepwalking episodes, or whether the thing that she's seeing or hearing is actually happening. And I think that was, yeah, a really good balance that Mariano Garcia manages to do. It's not easy, but she's obviously structured her world and the perceptions of her protagonist to such a, I guess, a balanced degree that the reader is often as unsure as Naomi whether or not she's dreaming or actually seeing the things that she's seeing, which is really, really excellent. Yeah, I don't know. It's weird because I'm saying so many good things about the book, and yet overall did not connect.
And this book, so I think this is either a fifth or sixth novel. I think it might be fifth. And this is the one that's really hit the mainstream. Yeah. So her previous novel, which I think is excellent.
It's been optioned for a series as well. I don't know if it's Netflix or Amazon. I'm pretty sure it's been optioned for a series. It might be Netflix, might be Amazon, one of those.
Yes. Gods and Jade Shadow was nominated, et cetera, for awards, but I don't think it hit New York Times bestseller level, whereas this has.
And you can see why this is the one that, like, you can – it's got a very cinematic quality to it in terms of the – you know, you can see this. You can see this book and the scenes and the house and all of this. You can see it on a screen. Like it lends itself perfectly to being adapted for the screen.
Yeah, the trailer for this.
Oh, yeah, right.
The opening moment as she's coming towards the house, and you know, which is described in the book as sick with rot, stinking of decay.
See, it's
it's evocative is the word I'd use. You can see the trailer.
And there's so much like with a lot of gothic, it's not necessarily difficult to adapt to screen, but there's a lot of interiority. There's interiority here too, but there's so much external visual things happening that this will be an amazing TV series, and I will probably watch the TV series so just to see what they do.
I think that's the one thing about this, there's a lot going on in this book. It's not a novel where the characters sort of stay in amber for about 100 pages. She's constantly trying to figure out what she's trying to save her cousin. Catalina's her cousin, isn't that right?
Yeah, it is.
So she's trying to save her cousin. Her cousin is sick. We haven't really mentioned that element, that her cousin is more not on her deathbed so much, but just there's some, she's not right.
And she's written a letter to Naomi's father saying that she's in trouble. And there's something happening, and can he do something? And he sends Naomi to try to sort it out, which, you know, in retrospect, good decision.
Yes. Yes.
You know, can you imagine?
It's interesting that he sends his daughter, but of course he doesn't know what he's sending her into. But,
no, he doesn't. Because he thinks marital dispute of some kind, and he doesn't quite trust the new husband either, but he thinks, a woman might be best positioned to try to mediate whatever the issue is.
And, yes, I don't remember what my point was.
We were talking about the layers, like all the things that are happening in the book. It's not...
Oh, yes. And, so when she turns up, what I liked is that it doesn't spend 70 or 80 pages with her, with everything sort of normal, with the odd bit of weirdness. It's weird from the get-go. Yeah. She knows it's not right here. And when the old doctor turns up and he also gaslights her and just talks a line of bullshit, she picks up on it. She knows. And she goes into the town, and which is not easy because they sort of want to keep her in the high place, the Doyle family. But she gets there and she learns and blah, blah, blah. And it's just constant information, learning about this little silver mine, which, again, I loved. Mm. And look, I understand you bounced off The Voice, but to me it's propulsive, and that's it. Again, I will pay florid prose if there's stuff going on and the novel is moving at a clip, which this one is. And I didn't expect the fungal stuff. The fungal stuff is not what I thought this was about. And so when we get to Fungal World, in the last 30 or 40 pages, I felt quite nauseous. And right. I didn't want to really eat mushrooms.
Yeah, it's look, there's a lot to really.
And let's be clear, I've read a lot of Jeff Vandermeer recently, and he loves
fungus. Oh, there you go. Yeah.
He loves fungus, but Lorena Garcia's take on fungus is quite revolting. Yeah. I warn you.
In a good way.
You don't think so? Well, yeah, in a good way. Yeah, yeah. Well, obviously. Duh. But you agree?
Yeah. Oh, no, I think it's like, as I said, there's a lot I liked about this book, but I liked it, I think, more from like an intellectual theoretical standpoint rather than like a readerly connection to the book. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like, I liked it a lot. I mean, I know one of, you know, from a craft level, one of the things that that just irritates me so much, always irritates me so much, is I guess the too much exposition, like the exposition on the level of why characters may or may not be saying something or doing something. And there was quite a little bit of this throughout the book. So a character would say something and you'd have in the, you know, in the prose, Virgil, you know, asked a question, comma, curious, you know, like she said this because she thought this, or, and you understand from the situation and from the crafting of the characters and the scene why someone has said something or looked a certain way, and I don't need the author to explain that at, you know, so explicitly. And that's, again, it's not going to bother a lot of readers. It just bothers me. I don't feel trusted as a reader to understand what the author's doing. And she does a good job. I never needed any of those explanatory notes. So,
yeah, didn't bother me, but that's okay. I say before we circle the drain, we go on to the next book.
Sure, we can do that.
Because I think we'll end up talking about Mexican Gothic as we talk about The Only Good Indians, because the thing that they have in common, which we didn't know when you chose these two books, because I didn't choose them.
No, they were just on my long list of books that I've been keeping during my PhD.
Yes, yeah, so you picked them randomly. And so we didn't know at the time that these are what is, you know, hashtag own voices stories. So
Oh,
so you just figured that out now.
I just hadn't thought about it.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, they are.
So they're both people writing within their culture, about their culture to some degree, you know, and maybe not, I mean, you know, Marina Garcia is writing about the 1950s Mexico, but still they're writing of their culture, which is what we don't see enough. And this, and we haven't spoken, you know, we'll get to Stephen's book in a sec, but that is what makes this so good, and I'm understating it here, that the Marina Garcia's book is on the New York Times bestsellers. It's the Only Good Indians is being discussed as well, wider than just genre world. It's in the mainstream out there. Could, you know, it's a sort of book that, you know, if the wind is right, could get nominated for a National Book Award.
That'd be nice.
The long list.
I'd like to see that.
If the wind is right. The wind has to be damn right. And writers like and Carmen Maria Machado has sort of opened the door.
Oh, she's so good. We should look at her short story.
To be a much stronger element. I mean, that book, by the way, was extraordinary. But this is really, really important. And, yes, we fluked picking these two books. Well, you did. But that is what connects them both, own voices, and the fact that they're both novels that have escaped the tight confines of genre for a much larger mainstream audience, which is wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I can do the Goodreads bit, okay?
I have the blurb here. I could read it.
It's really short on Goodreads.
It is really short. I like that. So the blurb for The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones is: seamlessly blending classic horror and a dramatic narrative with sharp social commentary, The Only Good Indians follows four American Indian men after a disturbing event from their youth puts them in a desperate struggle for their lives. Tracked by an entity bent on revenge, these childhood friends are helpless as the culture and traditions they left behind catch up to them in a violent, vengeful way. The creeping horror of Paul Tremblay meets Tommy Orange's There There in a dark novel of revenge, cultural identity, and the cost of breaking from tradition in this latest novel from the Jordan Peele of horror literature, Stephen Graham Jones.
Yeah, so that stuff in bold.
I'm not loving that last bit.
Yeah, that last bit's not great. So there's a couple of problems with it. First off, it refers to Tommy Orange's There There, which is a great book, was nominated for the National Book Award.
There we go.
So see, they're positioning it. See what they're doing there?
Yeah.
They're doing the literary positioning there. And it is about, you know, Native American culture, very much so. And it's one of those books, and I know we're not here to talk about Fair Fair, but it's one of those books that because it was so popular, everyone's going, oh, wow, a bit like I'm doing with The Only Good Indians, because it's about Native Americans who don't get, you know, don't get enough exposure in fiction. And so when we see it, we go, oh, isn't this astonishing? But we should actually be ashamed that we're astonished, if you know what I mean. So that was the same reaction to Tommy Orange's book, which is very much a suburban novel. It's got no fantastical elements, although there's a sort of weird terrorist bit in it. But it is structurally interesting. Oh, I don't know what I'm talking about. No. There. It's only because this bloody well refers to it. But the Jordan Peele of horror literature.
I like that. Considering Stephen Graham Jones has been publishing for...
He's written 22 books. He's been around forever.
Yeah. But also it's again, you know, it's, I guess it's linking the overlay of I guess, a racial social commentary with, you know, with whatever other content are in the books or the films. And it's a fair comment to make, but as you say, it's like, it's a fine line, isn't it? It's a fine line between pointing out what may be to a white Western reader unique or different about a book. And if you like what Jordan Peele does with his films, which I really do, I love Jordan Peele's work, then you might like what Stephen Graham Jones is doing with it. But they're quite different. They're quite different.
And he's also different to Paul Tremblay. That I also don't get either. Paul Tremblay, I've read a few of his novels and I like them. And they are creeping horror, but they're not particularly violent. He often dials down the violence.
Yeah,
I haven't read his latest, which could be quite gory.
I don't. But you do run the risk, I guess, of boxing certain authors because of their, you know, who they are, their personal, you know, characteristics, like their, you know, their race or their heritage or
But it's more than that,
and that can be an issue when you're not just looking at this as, hey, here's a really good book written about Native Americans by a Native American, instead of just, here's a really good fucking book. But you do need to do both, because it is important to amplify voices which haven't been amplified.
But this is a book that I think doesn't bear comparison to any other author, because when I was reading it, it felt beyond its content, the structure, the way you approach the structure, but also the content, it just felt different. It didn't feel like, oh, I can put it on this hangout or that, you know, that link into this category, categorization.
It's one of these, for me, it was one of these really, really rare books, and they get rarer for me all the time, where I read it and it's like, I need to read everything else this author has written.
Yes, I was the same. And this is a tragedy, by the way.
It's funny because...
My first Stephen Graham Jones book, and I've actually got three or four of his books on / Kindle ebook reader in the garage, mouldering away.
Right, yeah. Look, I almost have certainly read some of his short fiction in anthologies and so on. It's the first novel of his I've read, and his name has, like, it's been in the back of my mind for a few years as an author to look into because of what I've heard about his work. So I am both disappointed with myself for not getting onto him sooner, but also overjoyed that there's now so much Stephen Graham Jones back catalogue for me to work through.
But what about if you start it with his best piece of work and the rest is just...
Look, as this is his latest, it is quite conceivable that this is his best piece of work to date. But I'm sure
his
future work will be better. Yes, it was.
Was Mexican? Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right. So it was my second at first.
Yeah.
And I've been meaning to read the other three. But anyway, that's besides the point. I was the same. I read this and I thought, yeah, where have you been in my life? And I realised, you've been in my garage.
Sorry,
Stephen Graham Jones, you're not being an actual physically in my garage.
It is such a smart book. Like, it is super smart and super inventive, and from because let's talk about the magnificence of the fucking title from the start. Like, the title is the best, one of the best titles I've ever, like, it's just so good. The title itself has so many freaking layers and opens so many doors and already deposits in your head the Dead Indians line before you even open the book. And from the title all the way up to, did you read the acknowledgements? Oh my god.
Do you mean the 6-page acknowledgements? That's one broken paragraph.
The best acknowledgements I've ever, like, it was a thing of beauty to read, and it was, it's like a song. It's the most, like, acknowledgements. I
reads like someone who's been toiling at the coalface for decades, and has got this book out, and he's just, he can't contain the pure also joy of doing it, and it's amazing because this is not a debut. This is
Yeah.
Book 22. Yeah. And yet there is this feeling that he's just so rapturous about it. It's even sometimes some that acknowledgement.
The acknowledgement is amazing.
Better than the actual novel. And the novel's amazing.
I often will just like skim acknowledgements and I started reading these and it's like, oh my God, this is like, it's like a little short story on its own. It's like this bonus thing.
Yeah.
But that's just the extraneous matter, title and acknowledgement.
Yeah, I know.
Like the book itself.
And we've got a book here that's structurally it basically has a climax involving basketball. I mean,
oh my God, that pickup game is just a mate. Like I am not, as you know, Ian, I'm not a sports person.
I know. Don't really care. It's the Olympics.
Don't care about sports. And honestly, would never willingly pick up a sports novel. Funnily enough, I don't mind sports movies. There we go.
We learn so much about you.
I know. Because let's face it, sport has, you know, inherent narrative to it that's really great. And when you take it out of the real world, when the guys you want to win can and do often lose, and you make it a movie, fantastic popcorn movies, love sports movies, weirdly. I'm not going to say I don't like sport. I don't follow sport. I don't really care. I'm ambivalent. But that section, which is, as you say, several pages of a basketball game between Denora, who is one of the foreman's daughters, and the elk head woman, who is the vengeful entity of the blurb, is just amazing. And credit to the author, because I mentioned several times, I think, on this podcast that I'm not an incredibly visual reader and I don't automatically translate visuals in my head when I'm reading a book. But I could picture this game so well. He describes it so well in so much detail, but the detail is like the pacing is incredible, the density of the emotions of Denora, who we're getting that through her point of view for the most part. It's just amazing. It's absolutely gripping. And I just, yeah, I don't quite know how he did it. It's so good.
And that's the end. one of the main climactic bits. But before that, so you get this opening. It's not a prologue. It's I suppose the first chapter.
It's
essentially
the first chapter.
Where Ricky, the first of our four men, is murdered.
Yep.
And it's surreal and visceral and brilliant. And it's a short story.
Yep.
It's its own contained universe. And wow, does that not set the book up? I mean, tonally, it's just perfect. It's pitch perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a cliche, I know, but it is, isn't it? It is.
It is really good. Okay. And then it drops the reader away and
all the themes you're embedded in that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't.
And you could argue, well, it's going to be a, you know, just repeat for the rest of the book, but it isn't.
But it's not.
But it is extraordinary, that opening.
And when you go back and read it again after you've read the book, because one of the things that's so good about that opening is it's full of, like, it intrigues the reader. There's mystery set up. You don't exactly know what's happening. You don't quite know.
And why is there an elk suddenly?
Yeah,
running
right. There's a whole bunch of, and when you read it again, it's really sad. Like, it's really poignant. But no, so I guess after that first chapter, then you go and you sit with Lewis for a while, and he's probably half of the rest of the book. And then once Lewis
and because I'm reading it on an ebook, I don't know that Lewis is going to change halfway through. So I'm expecting the rest of the book to be through his.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
And as a reviewer, these are the sort of books that are really fucking hard to review. Not because I don't have plenty of good things to say about it.
Well, this is what's really interesting, because like that Goodreads, or the blurb that's on Goodreads when it says, you know, the Only Good Indians follows four American Indian men. It doesn't really follow four. Like not really a good, like, yes, okay, it's not untrue, but it doesn't really capture what the book is doing structurally.
No, and when you're writing reviews, you want to capture what the book is about, but you can't without having to speak about the second half, because the first bit and then the next bit, the three bits are connected but different, and you want to sort of capture that in a review. I'm in a sense glad I didn't review this for Locus, because I know I would have spent 3 weeks just trying to craft a bit of how I get that across.
Yeah, look, structurally,
I struggle doing that bit when I write.
Structurally, this book is amazing. Like the structure and the, like, here we have a book which is an omniscient narrator, and it's done so well. It's the type of omniscient narration I really, really love, and it's really smart. And yet at the same time, even though the book itself, the narrator is omniscient and we are outside the characters, we are also inside the characters. He does this really tricky thing of blending your omniscient narration with a third person direct a lot of the time, and then you know, that weaving of the second person in that from the midpoint of the book on. Oh God, there's so much I love about on a craft level about this book. It's really amazing. And can we talk about, like you said, this book's really gory and horrific. Can we talk about how clever that is? Because it's not the whole book. And so in Lewis's part, when, and also like content warning people, because this book killed me, because one of my things that I find incredibly difficult to deal with is cruelty and pain with animals. Like people don't care.
I was going to mention that.
Don't care.
That's
don't
my
care.
One quibble with the book.
But the animal stuff really, really gets to me. Honestly, nothing will turn me off a book quicker than gratuitous cruelty to animals. It's like, you know, it's that kind of thing where if you get a kitten that walks on stage at the beginning of the book, it's like, if you kill this fucking kitten, we are done. And when it is that gratuitous thing, when it's just really exploitative to the reader's reactions, I get very turned off by those books. And I think it's cheap and I think it's just – it's like, do better. And Stephen Jones does better because what he's doing – like, yeah. Can we talk about how with Lewis, right. with okay, Lewis's dog – so with Lewis's dog, there actually yes. isn't gore. Like go back and read the sections. It's implied. It's not explicit. And part of the reason for that,
he stomped.
Yeah, but it's not okay. If you compare what happens with Lewis's dog and the way, like it's awful. It's absolutely awful what happens. I'm not saying what happens is less worse than what happens with Cassidy's dogs at the end, but the way Jones describes both. The two different things, give, right? You don't yeah, he, with Lewis, it's like he tells you enough. He tells you enough. It's almost like you get a glimpse out of the corner of your eye. You know enough. You know enough, and that's fine, and it's horrible, and you feel a bit ill. And part of that is, I think, what the book is doing is because this is Lewis's dog. This is Harley, it's his dog that he loves that he's had for a decade, you know, and he like Lewis would not want to see that or dwell on that. In fact, when Harley's first just awfully almost killed, Lewis just goes away. And can we talk about how clever that is too? Because that's the first chink where you kind of go, Lewis, that's not right. Like you should be with your dog. You shouldn't just be pretending it's not happening and making your girlfriend deal with like Lewis. That's not great.
Yeah.
And so we don't see in any explicit detail exactly what's happened to Harley, what his body looks like. It's all corner of your eye. I don't want to look because Lewis doesn't want to look. And then when you get the dogs at the end, they're Cassidy's dogs, but it's not Cassidy who finds them, it's Gabe. Gabe doesn't care about those dogs. So then we get these awful, awful physical descriptions of what the dogs – what they look like, and like it's really explicit and really nauseating, and I've never quite seen or thought about what happens to interior organs.
It's pretty
but it's not your usual standard horror.
No, you're right.
You're right. It's really that, and it's like it's disgusting. But we get that explicitness because Gabe doesn't care about those dogs. So it's gross to him and he's disgusted, but he doesn't care.
That explicit versus implicit is brilliant. Yeah.
You can backfill that to Harley because of course that's what Harley must have looked like. Like it's so elegant, like it's funny to use the word elegant, but it's so elegant the way Jones has handled the gore in this book and how he has filtered it through the way that the character that we're with at the time would perceive that. And it's this amazing, as well as presenting this horror, which is, like it's a horror novel. It's, but no make mistake about it, it's an absolute down-the-line horror novel. And so he's giving you the gore, but he's also freaking building character with it. I have never seen.
you're right.
The treatment of gore and body horror done in the way he's used it also to build the character of the two people he's talking about. It's freaking brilliant.
Yeah, that whole Lewis first half is probably my favourite section of the book. I'd like the second half, but the Lewis, the first half is astonishing.
It just creeps up on you so slowly.
Well, the way he uses the gore with the death of spoilers, Shaney. And his girlfriend Jo, I think, and
Peter.
Again, completely shocked. The girlfriend, genuine jump. The girlfriend jumping out of your seat.
The girlfriend, sorry, Peter.
Oh, Peter. What? Yeah. Joe. Joe's the one. Joe's Cassidy's. Yeah.
Cassidy's wife.
Girlfriend. Yeah. Peter. You're right. Yes. Yeah. There's a joke made whether she's part of Peter.
Yes. Exactly. Anyway, yeah.
So the way he does that is also genuine jump scare stuff.
And it's so quick because it's such a, like, as I said, you get the hint with Harley, except it's from a different angle. But you get the hint that there's something you should maybe take a step back with from Lewis, and maybe you shouldn't be that close to him.
Lewis's descent into crazy world is also beautifully done.
So well done. And you don't see, and you know what, I didn't, him killing Shaney, expected, because that's what he's going to do that. It's flagged. Expected. I didn't see him killing Peter, and it happens so quick. It's like bang, bang, and then that magnificent birthing scene.
Which you're thinking, what the fuck is magic?
What the fuck is like, this? You think, is he imagining that's an elk? No, it's a fucking elk he pulls out of her. It's like other people see the elk eventually, and of course we see what the elk is. And again, can we talk about how that scene? In the language and the structure and the way Jones describes that, it's so reminiscent of the both the initial massacre of the elk at the beginning with the elk baby pulled out of its mother's corpse, and then later at the end, at the very end, when the elk baby again is pulled out of the snow, and like the same language is used. It's the most beautiful poetic link through. I need to read this book again. I skimmed back through a few bits once I'd finished it, but I need to read it again.
It's rare to read a book that is this thematically and structurally perfect. And we haven't really spoken about the themes because it is about Native American culture. Mm. It's about tradition. And
you know what?
It's also about
This is a Gothic book. This book is square in the contemporary Gothic genre. It's at the gory end, but it's fucking – it is Gothic as fuck. Like, it is all about the past haunting the present. Oh, it's all about the sins of the fathers. It's like literally it is – there is so much Gothic in this book. It's
also
amazing.
About the tension of tradition itself, of old traditions where actually hunting elk, because in certain parts of America that's banned, and there was actually a Supreme Court case I did research last year about a Native American who'd hunted elk for food and was taken to was put in jail, I think, and it went up to the Supreme Court, and they actually said yes, that he had the right to do so. So there's this tension within America itself and within the traditions of Native American tribes as to whether you do or don't. I mean, the one of the key points of this is that the elk that they hunt, that is the catalyst of his entire story, they've been told, everyone's told, this is not, you do not hunt here. This is where the elders go.
Yeah, so they've violated all kinds of laws.
Correct. So they haven't just broken the taboo, secular law. They've broken their own traditional taboos by doing this. And, oh, my God, this scene, the scene when Lewis is recalling what happened.
Yeah.
And he's talking about how there were 100 elk just standing there and they're just shooting them. Bang, bang, bang. It is
horrible.
Wow. Cliche world, stomach wrenching, a gut punch, all the words that I would chuck in a review. It is, I'm tearing up a bit. It is,
and
just
then
fucking,
and then what happens with the young elk who's the center of the story? It's just, and
I did a little bit in my head dub Jesus elk, but that's because I'm a terrible person.
Don't do that
because that elk felt something. Well, because it's described as being too young to have had a calf as well. It's obviously something supernatural inherently about that, or preternatural maybe about that elk
potentially
to begin with. But anyway, so that's how I thought of it. But bad Ian. But still, wow. And the snow and the cold and the isolation and then that isolation, how that translates to Denora's climax.
I think one
and
of the
running.
Yeah, I think that look, that's a phenomenal scene. I think one of the very, very possibly only missteps in the whole novel actually is in that chapter, because so you have this story and most of it really is flashback and you're there with the men as this happens, and particularly with Lewis. And in that chapter, because Lewis is telling Shaney what has happened, what happened 10 years ago. And so in that chapter, Jones will just keep cutting back just for a line or two to remind us, like back to the garage or the back steps. I forget where they're sitting when Lewis.
They actually start, I think, in the dining room, so, and then they move to the steps as he tells the story.
And he'll just keep going back every page and a half to put us back in the present with Lewis and Shaney. And I thought that, that felt like a misstep. I think he let the readers off the hook, and he gave us kind of a breath to step back from the horror of that scene. And it's like, you should have left us there. You should have left Lewis there. You should have dumped us in that for the whole thing. And then at the end, we would have kind of emerged blinking and traumatized and back in Lewis's house. Yeah. And it wasn't like, it didn't destroy the book or anything by any means, but I just felt it was just, for me, it was a small misstep. And it was almost it was the only point at which I felt the book the narrator kind of flinched. And I thought, you should have left us all there. You should have left Lewis there. You just should have left us. Like, we know in the back of our minds that this is what Lewis is telling Shaney. When you bring us back out, we remember that. And that's just small misstep. I thought it could have just been a much more prolonged and well-paced.
Well, let's not end on a negative.
But no, that's the one tiny, as I said, the one tiny potential misstep. But like, I just, oh God, I don't know. This novel was so good. And Jones does this amazing thing, which it's something I've been thinking about for a couple of decades, actually, ever since I saw Psycho back at uni for the first time, or not the first time, but when I really watched Psycho properly. And the Hitchcock Psycho, obviously. So what the movie Psycho does is this really clever thing where you have your protagonist character who's, you know, you like her, you're on her side, she's in a bad place, she's stolen the money from her job and she's gone off to run away and do stuff, and it's not a good thing that she's done, but you kind of get why she's done it. And then she gets to this motel and she kind of thinks, and she goes, oh no, I should, and she decides to go back, and she's already spent someone a car, but okay, whatever, she's going to go and return the rest and explain herself and throw herself on the mercy of her boss, and you're so, she's so like complex but likable, and you really are on her side. And then of course she gets murdered. And what that does to the audience, it builds up this huge well of emotional attachment to this character who you are assuming is going to be the protagonist, right, of this movie. You're assuming we're going to follow her through the movie, and then suddenly she's gone and we've got this basket of attachment. It's like, what do I do with this? Where do I put this? Oh, Norman, he looks like a nice guy. Okay, he's a bit creepy, the birds and stuff, but let's give it to Norman. And that's what we do with Psycho, and that's how that movie gets to pull the whole freaking thing over our eyes for so long, because we've taken this emotion that we built up for her, whose name I can't even remember. That's terrible. I remember the actress's name.
Vivian Leigh's character.
Yeah, but I can't remember the character's name. But we've built all of that up for, is it Marion? Anyway, built it up for her, and we're left with it, and we don't know what to do with it. So we throw it to the next best available option, which is our worst decision as an audience for Psycho. But we do. And Jones does the same thing with the Good Indians. We've got all of this attachment to Lewis. Ricky was chapter one, and it's cool. Set up the book, great. We've got no real attachment for Ricky. We're now going to see what the book is doing. And it's Lewis. And we're with him for a long time. And we build up so much attachment. And then what happens at the end of his section with the awful things that he does, it's like we have to take a step back. And then he's killed anyway. So it's like, again, what do we do with this? What do we do with all this emotion we built up? Oh, the elkhead woman, we'll give it to her. She can have it, which again, really bad fucking decision on the part of the readers. But he herds us into this freaking canyon where she's what's there. So we're going to give it to her.
Because he makes the choice of not making Denora the main point of view character.
That's right. We've got to give it to the elkhead woman and we're there, and we give it to her. And it's a bad decision because she's not great. In fact, she's she's a monstrous creature. But we, like Norman Bates, we don't see that at first, and we're very sympathetic, and we give all of that attachment to her. And it's so fucking smart what he does as an author. And I think I've seen it done very few times. But it's really, really smart, and he does it so well. And so then we're with her. And the fact that he then brings her in second person, it's almost like, you know, I love second person, as you know. I think it's a really underutilized, yes. Possibly actually perfectly utilized, because it's can be
it's
done really
well. It's gotten a bad rap over many, many years.
And normally when you are second person, it's around the character that they're talking about, but you're being invited in to sit in their place as a reader, and that's usually how an author employs second person. It's not how Stephen Jones employs it. He is not inviting us in to sit with the Elkhead woman. It's almost as though she, as an entity, as a force in this book, she's just too much for the narrator to contain. So he has to address her outside of the narrative of the book, because she can't be contained. Like, it's so fucking amazing. This book is just, yeah. Oh my God. It's such a clever
book. I have nothing more to add to what you just said. I think I've said my bit. I loved it.
Yeah. I adore this book. This seriously is such a good book. I haven't read a book this smart from a structure and craft level
also,
in a very long time.
We've both are long-time horror fans. Mm. But I think both of us, I know I have, and I'm pretty sure you have to an extent, have gone off horror to one degree or another. Not completely. We'll always have that connection.
Mm. I get impatient
but I know,
with a lot of
I know you
horror.
Personally have read a lot of horror where you've gone,
I read and watch a lot of horror, and I dismiss most of what I read and watch because
yeah,
it seems
this cheap is the sort of book that can revitalise an entire genre, except it's so its own thing, it probably can't revitalise the genre. but you see what I'm but you think,
but it's
you realize
smart
you
and
it.
What this book reminds me of this is what good horror fiction does. It actually horrified. It's not fucking fun to read. Like, it's not fun at all, ever. But it is an intensely amazing experience.
Give a rap that isn't fun, that is difficult to read because it's gratuitous or splatterpunk or whatever, and it's just gore for the sake of gore.
Yeah.
And this is, we said, a violent book, but it's the way the violence is used. It's the way the gore is used. It's the deliberate nature of it all that only just accentuates all the themes that surround the book, and makes it such an extraordinary read.
It's that emotional gut punch. And I think, like, to go back very briefly to Mexican Gothic, I think for me that's one of the differences, and not just with these two books, but with the type of book that I connect with. Mexican Gothic quite reasonably and quite beautifully revels in its baroqueness and its gore, and it's, you know, yes, it's disgusting and everything, but it's fun to read about that, right? It's fun. Whereas it's not fun to read about what happens in The Only Good Indians. You know, it gets you on that core emotional level that makes it, instead of being a romp and one of those books or movies you watch in the horror genre which are just fun to watch, and, you know, all of the freaking, I don't know, slasher films and the Halloween films and the Freddy films, like, they're just fun. You watch them, they're fun. If you like horror, obviously, they're just fun. This book and books like this, they're not fun to read. They are deeply horrific to read, and I think they're the best books in the genre, and we don't get enough of them. And I can't even explain why it's an enjoyable experience when it's not an enjoyable experience at all when you're reading it.
I perfectly said that is right. That is, and yes, and my favorite author, King, is the master still of doing that sort of doing that sort of novel that keeps you in it, but is hard, difficult, not entertaining, in the sense of the Freddy slasher novels.
Yeah,
This is not the same as a King novel. I do not want to compare. It's not in the same universe. No. But yeah, oh, look, you've said it perfectly. I don't want to say too much more.
What this book does, as I said, in almost every element, like I think it really throws the gauntlet down. Like you say, this has the ability to revitalize the genre, and I think, you know, not because people should start writing a book like this, but I think it reminds us who work and read in the genre what
it reminds us what horror is meant to do,
what it's capable of doing. Yes. And it's capable of being smart and intelligent and manipulating the readers in the best possible way. That's, you know, not that I want, I do not want people to go out and go, oh, well, we're going to start writing books like The Only Good Indians, but I want people to be reminded that, you know, despite all of the detractors that the genre always gets, because I always will be a horror writer and reader, always. And despite the detractors that the genre gets and always will get, it is a fucking smart genre, or it can be. And it has an ability that few other genres get to run with, which is to really tap into that, I guess, that emotional darkness. The emotional, well, not the, I mean, any genre can explore the base instincts of human beings, all right? But it gets to tap into the readers, that the darkest of our emotions, and keep us on the page. And other genres don't get to do that. So yeah, I want to see more smart horror, definitely more. And I guess that's where I like the Jordan Peele comparison, not because Jordan Peele is writing, you know, quote unquote black horror, and Stephen Graham Jones is writing Native American horror or First Nations horror or Indian horror, whatever. I love the commentary in the book about, you know, the use of Indian or First Nations or Native American and your generations and what you identify with as a person, what you were called when you were growing up, and that's still your, you know, and that's, and this is a debate that goes through a lot of you know, minority cultures. Like it's a debate in the queer community, because if you're an older person, the word queer, you may not like that word. It may have been a word that was insulting to you when you were young, and you can't get on board with bringing that word back. So it, language is a conversation that's had all the time, and I love that it was in this book. Throughout the book, it was a really nice thing. But that's what I think the comparison comes to. It's not so much, you know, the social commentary from a racial point of view thing that links Peele and Jones, which, you know, it does. But it's the intelligence of their writing, and with Peele's scripts and with this book by Jones, obviously I haven't read any others, but the intelligence of the way they craft their stories and the new ways they find to instill this kind of genuine, visceral, emotional horror in the readers, which is really hard to do. It is really hard to do that to people, and this book does it, and the work of Jordan Peele does it really well too, and that's what connects them.
It doesn't work for me, but I that is a very good post-hoc explanation. I don't like it. I don't think this is one book where...
Oh, no, I don't like the boxing in, but if you're going to, that's what I'd prefer the connection to be, that they're both really, really fucking smart horror writers.
Let's move on.
Okay, so yes, that's so you can tell which book I liked a little bit more.
I love both books.
Yeah, look, I didn't dislike Mexican Gothic. It's not for me. There's a lot I really liked about it on an intellectual level. I just didn't connect with it. But as you can tell, listeners, oh my god, did I connect with The Only Good Indians? In fact, it's so funny because I finished it Thursday night. And then I...
Oh, my God, I finished Thursday night as well.
Yeah, I just finished. And then last night I went to bed and it's like, oh, now I get to read. Oh, no, I finished it. I felt bereft. But, yeah, so that's The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones. And before
we'll end up with this thing.
Oh, yeah.
They are both good. Look, again, you didn't connect with Mexican Gothic. Mm-hmm. But for me, they're both good COVID-19 novels in the sense that... Mexican Gothic, I think, is propulsive and is fun. It is fun.
It does
some very smart, clever things around post-colonialism, et cetera, which is the early part of the podcast. And Stephen Graham Jones' novel is so brilliantly horrific and terrifying that you can't look away. So you do end up let's be clear. My attention was glued on both books, and COVID could be forgotten. So for me, both these books get can you read this while the world is falling apart because of COVID-19 tick of approval?
I'll give that to The Only Good Indians.
All right, what are we doing next?
So next episode, again, we've each chosen a book. Next episode, mine again is a random choice. It's from my list of books that I've been wanting to read, and I've chosen Folk by Zoe Gilbert, which is a book that came which you've read. I know it came across my radar a couple of years ago when it was first out,
because I recommended it to you
and several other people, because obviously obviously doing a PhD about fairy tales, a fairy tale book comes out and everyone you know links it on Facebook and says, hey, Kirsten, have you read this one? Do you want to read this one? You should read this one.
It's like accidental.
And I am immediately going, I'm not reading any more fiction. I'm doing it. Don't talk to me. Don't even. But I put it on my list and now I have a beautiful paperback with a lovely cover and that's my choice for next month. And then Ian chose The Liar's Dictionary by Eli Williams or yes, Elay Williams.
Yes. I don't know, but
you don't know.
Yes. I chose it because I read her, Eli Williams' first book, which is not a novel, it's a collection, Atrib and Other Stories, and it's just wonderful. And there was no way I was going to pass up the first novel. So
awesome. So this is a debut novel because I haven't read that author.
Yes.
In fact, I haven't even heard of that author, so I'm excited to read it.
Yes, it's her collection won the Republic of Consciousness Prize, which I think is one of the, for just people out there who've never heard of the Republic of Consciousness Prize, it's probably one of the best literary awards going around because it focuses on small presses only. It doesn't look at the big publishers, and there are gems that you find there, and this was one of them.
I will need to look that up every year. Excellent.
Yes, you will. Excellent. I'm now making you. And I was always going to read her first novel, and here we are. I'm now going to put it to the test of writer and the critics, so that you can now rip it apart because that's what you do. The things that I choose,
not
read and go, Ian. No.
Hey, can I just point out that I chose both books this month, and I did not like one of them. So. Next month. So The Liar's Dictionary by Elay Williams and Folk by Zoe Gilbert. As usual, you can send your feedback to us by commenting at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, or on our Patreon if you're one of our patrons. You can send an email to writerandcritic@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at writerandcritic. And thank you again to our current patrons. We love you. We appreciate the support. If you can sponsor us on Patreon, we'd love to see you there. But our podcasts will and always will remain free to listen to and download for anyone. So that's us for August. Oh, my God. Can you believe it's August? What the hell?
What year is it?
I don't think any of us will forget that it's 2020. I think we'll be writing 2020 as a date for like the next decade.
Who remembers when 2016 was the shit year?
Yeah, what happened in 2016? It seems like a walk in the park now.
Correct. We've got to stop doing that, saying that 2020, because history will come and fucking bang us in the ass.
It is like just setting up 2020 to say, well, hold my beer, isn't it?
Correct. Well, 2024, 2025 going. Yeah, you thought that was bad.
I will say that I do think the whole thing is my fault.
You started COVID.
And I do apologize because I did two things. I did one thing at the end of last year, which is I stopped saying, because I'd been saying for the last 5 years, well, next year just has to be better. So I stopped saying that because I thought that's just silly.
Yeah.
What I started saying was next year will be different. And oh boy, have we gotten different. So I apologize, people. And then the other thing that I did at the beginning of 2020, which I hadn't done for, I can't remember the last time, more than a decade, 20 years, I bought a diary because I'd started a new job and I thought, I'm going to get a year planner and plan my year. So again, everybody in the world, I am so sorry. The whole thing is my fault.
Yeah, well, you're completely to blame, and you're explaining why I'm in lockdown right now. So thanks, Kirsten.
You are very welcome.
No problem. Thank you. All right, well, that's for us. On that cheery COVID-19 related note, let's go.
We'll see you next month, people. Happy reading. Talk to you soon. Bye.
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 I'm doing a rant.
You're doing rant.
My voice is rising in pitch.
I know.
And yet you want me to get to the...
I thought you had reached the pinnacle of your rant.
No, I'm not done peak rant yet. And you rule my rant, and I'm never going to recover.